For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she, too, can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, quick word from our friends at Mubi. Mubi is the video streaming service that the discerning viewer is looking for. It's a curated online cinema streaming exceptional films from around the globe. Every day there's a new movie. Just one new movie, so you don't have to do the like scrolling. They've picked out a good film for you to watch, whether it's a timeless classic, a thought-provoking documentary, or an acclaimed masterpiece. There are always 30 perfectly curated movies to discover on Mubi. Plus, you can dive deeper into the films with exclusive interviews, video essays, and critical reviews on Mubi's notebook. Try Mubi free for 30 days at Mubi.com. That's Mubi.com/longform. Again, Mubi.com/longform for a free trial. Thanks to them for sponsoring the show. I have one more announcement before we get started, which is that we have t-shirts. Finally, after I don't know how long, Longform Podcast t-shirts are available right now. Go to longform.org/shirt. That's longform.org/shirt. They've got the logo up there, the lighthouse, the radio waves. It is all there for you. And we need a bunch of people to go buy them soon. It's like one of these campaigns where there's like a limited window or the t-shirts don't get made. So go to longform.org/shirt. Thank you for your patience. I think you're going to like the shirts. Aaron picked them out. They're top quality. Here's the show. Hello, welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Back at home here in the studio.
Here we are, you guys, together once again.
I don't hear a single keg being thrown downstairs.
Thank you, Forno Rosso.
Max, what about the show this week? Did you interview anyone?
I did. In fact, I interviewed two people.
Wow.
I think a first for this show, I interviewed a married couple, Jim Fallows and Deb Fallows, who just wrote a book together called Our Towns. And basically what they did is they flew around the country and they went to small cities and towns to figure out what's actually going on in places like Sioux Falls and Burlington and spots all over the country. It's a very ambitious project. It was done sort of in conjunction with The Atlantic, where Jim has worked for, in his words, forever. And it was cool. We talked about how you write a book with your spouse. Seems daunting.
Did you get into their China years also?
Talked about their China years. So they have, for decades now, basically since their kids were out of high school, have spent part of their lives in Washington, D.C., and part of their lives in places all over the world. So they'll just move. They moved to China for 4 years. They lived in Indonesia for a long time. And then they just did this project flying around America. So they've really lived this like pretty adventurous life. I found it the whole thing like
they're
pretty
like,
inspiring.
They're like missionaries, but for journalism.
Yeah, they're kind of like journalistic missionaries. And also they are, you know, they can buy senior citizen Metro cards at this point, and they're still doing this.
And when you say flew, am I correct in thinking that they flew like flew their own plane?
Yeah. Jim Fallows is a pilot and they have a little propeller plane and they flew around themselves. Yeah, that was how they did it. So they like land in little commuter airports, and that was part of how they picked the towns, is it had to have a little like janky commuter airport.
If you've been flying around trying to deliver messages to people like a 1930s Bush pilot, there's a better way with an email newsletter. MailChimp makes the easiest one to use. You don't even need to pay until your list has a certain number of people on it. And once you get going, they've got all kinds of great features, analytics, one-page landing page things, all kinds of stuff that's going to be helpful for you. So thanks to MailChimp. They help make this show possible.
I can't believe you didn't use the landing page transition.
Oh! All right, I'm just leaving. I have to resign my position here.
And now here's Max with Deb and Jim Fallows.
Hi, Deb. Hi, Jim.
Hello,
hey,
Max.
Hey, Max.
How are you guys?
We're doing great.
We are peppy, and we're glad to be in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, yeah.
You seem peppy. You seem at full pep.
I'm not aware of having been on Flatbush Avenue before in my life, so that was exciting for me.
Yeah, you've kind of landed in what I like to think of as sort of the armpit of Brooklyn.
Well, it has its sort of vibrant city charm to it.
Yeah, it's we have like a majestic view of a mobile station. It's not the most beautiful part of the borough.
And you have a Brooklyn Bridge in your heritage.
Yes. There's a whole story, which is too long to tell now, but sort of the story of how my mother's family, which actually had a lot of hardship, could have made it big, would be if one of her mother or grandmother had married the people who built the Brooklyn Bridge. And so then we would have been on Easy Street.
Oh,
but
yeah.
We weren't.
It nearly happened.
Nearly happened. And then...
Of course, then maybe you wouldn't be here, so
yeah, that's
none
right.
of us would be
yes,
here today.
So
except Max.
You guys have... I feel like you're like on the circuit. You've been doing all these interviews about your book.
We just started doing that, and actually its pub date is tomorrow. But yes, we have a very interesting tour ahead, some of the big cities, but a lot of what we call fondly the Villes, Knoxville, Louisville, Greenville, Nashville.
Yeah, those are your spots now,
they're,
right?
They're our towns.
And plus Kansas City, plus
Spurville.
Redlands.
Yep.
Well, since you went right to our towns, can you give me the short version of the book?
So my short version is, over the last 4+ years, we've been going around to the parts of America, usually written about only when there's a tornado or shooting or the Iowa caucuses, and seeing what's it like to treat them as sort of independently interesting places. And the heart of our argument is, if you didn't know about national politics, you would feel much better about this stage of American life, that city by city, lots of places feel as if they're moving forward rather than backwards.
What's your version?
I'm going to add on to Jim's version, which is that we went aiming for towns where people generally don't go unless they're from there. Not the big city towns where you know the story or have an impression. Not the what we kind of called fancy towns, like...
Like Aspen.
Yeah, like Aspen, that people have heard of and have a strong impression of. But more the towns that we wanted to see for ourselves what was there without a first or media impression.
What was the genesis? Like, why go do this project?
I'll tell you again, you'll see a sort of ongoing yin-yang balance here of my view and the actual view. My view is that we've been living in China for a long time, traveling around and coming back to the U.S. during the time of economic collapse, wanting to know what it was like, you know, to try to do the small town approach we'd used in China too. Also, I guess, you know, the real reason from my point of view, for a long time, we'd been around the country in a little propeller airplane, and there's a version of the classic American road trip that is simply more interesting that way than it is any other way. More interesting, number one, because it's prettier. You're not just seeing the interstate and the Quickie Mart and the gas station, but you're seeing the whole panorama of the country. So it's interesting that way. Second, it's interesting because you go places you wouldn't otherwise go. You wouldn't go to these places in Wyoming and Nebraska and Iowa and South Dakota because they're not on the interstate, but they have little airports.
Right. That was the other, that was like the third metric, right? Was there needed to be a little like
a little
airport.
Right. But there are 4,000 or 5,000 of those. So it's really easier than finding an interstate.
Right.
You can just skip over that. And I guess the other reason that we wanted to do this, a couple more reasons, One is it felt like the national narrative of where the country was going was kind of at odds with what we had seen when we'd been flying around to small towns, that the mood seemed pretty dark and dysfunctional. And yet when we'd land in Red Oak, Iowa, or Rock Springs, Wyoming, we'd think, gee, this is an interesting place. Look at all the stuff that's going on here. And it kind of resonated with us since we grew up in small towns and found them very interesting and compelling. So we thought that we would once again hit the road, which has been our pattern.
I want to talk to you about that instinct, but it is interesting to me that you guys keep just using the word interesting. Like, it's interesting to fly instead of drive, and there's something interesting about these towns. And there was a line in the sort of excerpt in The Atlantic that you wrote that really grabbed me, and I'm just going to read it back, and then I was hoping maybe you guys could just explain this idea to me a little bit more, because I think it's basically about what is interesting. This is the line that I wrote down. Reporting is the process of learning what you didn't know before you showed up. And so my question is kind of like, what didn't you know about these places? And they are places about which I feel like the coasts have lots of preconceived notions. And I'm interested in how you approach that reporting process, like how you show up in a small town in Iowa and don't seem like some coastal asshole elites.
Well, for starters, we're not.
So the credo of reporting, you know, what you don't know till you show up, that is my basic, you know, that's my this I believe. That's the reason I've stayed in this line of work for lo these many decades, just because there's nothing more fascinating that you can do of just serially satisfying your curiosity about things. What's it like on an aircraft carrier? What's it like in a Chinese coal mine? What's it like in a giant data center in where do we go?
Oregon.
In Oregon. What, you know, what is it like in all these things? And journalism gives you a structural excuse to go do those. And it seems to me, or seemed to us, that people have, not just in the U.S., but around the world, people have a multi-dimensional mental picture of life in Brooklyn, let us say, or New York, or San Francisco, or L.A., because we've seen movies, and you've read novels, and everybody's been there, and there is a sense of the goods and the bads, and the different neighborhoods, and all that, and you really have a flattened 2D or even 1D view of a lot of other places that aren't normally in the media, even worse after the last election than before, because usually these places were used as props for concept pieces. While we see from the election results, those people out there must be really angry. Let's go out there and ask them how angry they are. And as a side point, if you ask people questions that they're used to hearing in cable news discussions, they'll just give you the cable news answer. So we didn't ask that. We just asked them, what's the story of the town? What's the story of your family? How's this different from your parents' time? What's getting better? What's getting worse? And the perpetual surprise of journalism is, number one, people are usually willing to talk about themselves. And number two, people are interested in their own story. They like telling their own story. They like telling the saga of their family, of the community. And so just going there without a preconception, oh, you pathetic lumpen proletariats, how angry are you exactly? And are you still fooled by Trump? That's not what we asked them.
So at the very beginning of this project, when we were wanting to find interesting places to go see and thought that they would be stories that had a narrative to tell, Jim posted something on his blog at The Atlantic saying that we were about to undertake this project and we were trying to figure out where to go. So where should we go? Tell us about your town. And that was what really kicked this off. Within about a week, we had nearly 1,000 responses from people saying, come to my town and here's why. So at that point, we thought, okay, maybe we're onto something here. People, there's a lot going on in these towns and people want to tell their stories. The beginning of figuring out where we should go was really hit or miss. We were making this up, but we followed a lot of those leads and did, you know, what would you do? You'd go on the internet and kind of see how their city website or their town website looked. Was there vitality there or not? Sometimes there was, sometimes there wasn't.
How do you judge like a town website for vitality?
Well, I'll tell you, I worked in college admissions for a while, and after reading 2,000 applications, you just get a sense of things. You can just tell what's between the lines and if there's something true. And it was the same thing for, did somebody put any effort into making this? And is it more than just a bulletin board of the open hours for the Chamber of Commerce and when the post office is open? Or are they celebrating things? And are they talking about why we are inviting you to come to such and such an event, or why this is a good place to move to, and the real estate prices are great, or our schools are great, just kind of the background enthusiasm on things. Then we'd look up the demographics and the history and so forth, and sometimes get in touch with the people who wrote to us. And then we'd just throw a dart at the map and say, weather looks good there. How about if we head there? And we landed with a fear that maybe we'd made the wrong decision, but we'd committed for a while. And our first day on the ground, we would generally go see what we called were the usual suspects, the newspaper editor, if there was a paper, the mayor or the city manager, somebody in charge of the schools, somebody connected to business or town development. And we'd say, what's going on here? And who are the interesting people in this town? Who's making this town work that we should go talk to? And what schools should we go see? So by the end of the day, we had a pretty good list of some good starting points, and we divvied it up according to our skills or lack thereof. And Jim would find out about the policy and the business and economics behind the town and the Main Street development. And I'd go to the schools and the library, and we'd both go to the brew pubs together to just hang out and go to the public recreation places to get a feel for it and start our research.
Hey, I'm going to put Deb and Jim on hold for a second and tell you about some sponsors that are making today's show possible. First up, writers, you are listening to this because it's a long-form podcast. You know you need discipline. It takes courage, commitment, and focus to push through creative blocks, extract stories from your head, and get them written down in the real world. If you're looking for structure and organization to help you write a bestseller or make an impact with your story, check out the Self Journal. More than a planner, this powerful productivity and success tool will help you structure your day around your goals and the tasks that are important to you. So no more excuses that you don't have time to write, that you're blocked, whatever. With the Self Journal, you can be intentional with your day, make time for creativity, and free up space for deep focus that gets you in the zone. It's loved by writers. The Self Journal will help you get better at your craft by creating the quality time you need to sharpen your skill. I can almost guarantee that if you're listening to this show, you have at some point struggled with writing. Why not try the Self Journal? You can find out more at bestself.co/longform. Again, that's bestself.co/longform. You can get 15% off your Self Journal. Give yourself a shot. Also sponsoring the show today, Radius from Thermacell. It's the world's first rechargeable zone mosquito repellent, of course. Just turn it on. Mosquitoes gone. With the Radius Repeller, you stop mosquitoes in flight, not on your skin, so you don't have to bother with messy, smelly, oily sprays. The compact Radius Repeller creates a 110-square-foot mosquito protection zone. TM. Not really TM, I just said that. The secret is the use of heat to disperse a highly effective, scent-free repellent. Radius is push-button simple. It features a rechargeable battery and a repellent cartridge that offers up to 40 hours of protection. You can use it anywhere. Your backyard, at a campsite, on a picnic, on your vacation. Radius comes with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Discover for yourself why Thermacell mosquito repellers are the highest rated zone mosquito repellents. I gotta tell you, my wife hates nothing more than mosquitoes. She tracks them at night. If there's a mosquito in our room, she just will not quit until that mosquito is gone. I've got to try Radius from Thermacell. It literally might change my life. I cannot tell you the degree to which mosquitoes bother this person that I live with. It is her kryptonite. And I'm going to try it. Here's how I'll do that. I'm going to go thermacell.com. That's thermacell.com. And I'm going to enter the code longform. And I'm going to get 20% off that Radius from Thermacell. Again, that's thermacell.com, and enter the code longform for 20% off. I'm literally going to do that right now before summer really starts and my partner's entire mental pie chart is taken over by mosquitoes. Okay, Let's get back to Deb and Jim. When you would go to the like city manager, mayor, and then the newspaper editor and all the stakeholders, how often did those like stories of the town line up with each other?
We wanted to keep asking until they did. We were talking recently with some social scientist who was complaining about the non-scientific basis of our work. And, oh, you know, duh. I mean, this is not scientific, but it's repertorial. And what you do is you try out hypotheses, which you don't call that. You just try out your theories and your hunches and your impressions, and you hear it from one person, you ask the next person about that, and they agree on 60%, they differ on something else. And by the time you've talked to 30 or 40 people, you have an idea of what everybody's saying and what nobody is noticing and what they're contradicting on. So I think from the craft as opposed to science of reporting, you get some sense. But I have another point too, which is a renegade point. My experience in dealing with, so I've worked for The Atlantic forever, and The Atlantic is now a big time, you know, very long and established East Coast media outlet. And I've observed over the decades people from the coastal media outlets in, I think, two modes. There's some of them who sort of carry themselves as the talent and the person from out of town, the person with a fancy suit, and the person who was sort of waiting for you to ask him or her their impressions on politics. And
let me get that. That's the Jim model.
Yes, you've anticipated me. And we are probably grossly self-deluding, but we think of ourselves, each of us, as from a small town happening to work for a big-time coastal operation. But I think we felt as if we were in solidarity with people from places like us. So do you agree with that, Ms. Deb, or not?
I do. And so Jim and I also come from really different, quote, journalistic or reporting backgrounds, unquote, being that Jim has been a journalist his entire life. And I'm not yet a journalist. I'm kind of a normal person, but one from the Midwest who likes to listen to people and watch people and likes to get out and get around. So I did less formal interviewing than you did, and I did a lot of observing, which is my strong suit, I guess, going into classrooms and just sitting there for long periods of time, watching how the teachers interact with the kids and watching what the kids say. Or sometimes we went to, people would invite us over for dinner and they'd have a gaggle of their high school kids, and they're real easy to talk to because you just ask a few questions and they start opening up and talking about things. So it was kind of a combination of formality and informality. And in the informal parts, I think, was where we also got a strong sense of, have these stories we've been hearing, do they ring true when people are just chatting and just talking, rather than giving us a formal answer to a formal question? And that was at one point where I actually felt most like, yeah, I've heard this before.
Sorry, what's the part that you've heard before?
Whatever they were talking about, like, I love living in Sioux Falls because it's a safe city. My kids can go outside after school and they can go down to the mall, rather than hearing the chief of police say, this is a safe city.
Oh, right. You're talking about where the story started to line up.
Yes.
How was it working together?
We never disagreed.
We've been working together our whole life. So I think one of the advantages is that since Jim has been a writer his whole life, he's always worked at home and been around in the house all through the time the kids were growing up in the attic or the basement or wherever he was finding a place to work, and saw the scrum of daily life where the kids were, you know, running around the house or whatever was happening, so that it wasn't like suddenly we started working together. We've been leading our life in all its complications together for way many more years than you are old. So this was only different in that we were actually finally formally writing a book together.
And I think this was so much a joint effort that we take for granted. We don't notice how unusual it is actually to have people at this stage of life from different professional backgrounds actually sharing the labor.
But I think we'd also watched each other work in our various ways for so many decades that we knew what was coming. We knew what to expect. We knew what each of us was better and worse at. So we didn't even have to talk about, you know, you cook, I'll do the dishes, in terms of you go talk to these people, I'll go talk to these people. You fly the plane, I'll make the arrangements, and I'll do ground control. That
what was surprising
about our
about the whole adventure together?
Yeah, about writing a book with your spouse. It's got to be something you didn't anticipate.
So the way the book is structured for the minority of the listenership who's not already bought it and read it is in successive chapters by Deb and me, or sections, you know, maybe 1,000 words long, 2,000 words long, set off by different little icons, visual cues, a little airplane for me, a quill pen for Deb. And I guess a surprise to me is that our very different voices, I think more different in writing than they are actually, you know, listening right now, that actually I think they have a complementary balance, and different parts of what we saw come through in the alternation between the way we're writing about them.
For me, it was the mechanics of doing this were a little bit surprising, because there's one thing that we knew already, which is that I work in the daytime and Jim works in the nighttime. I work better when I know I have plenty of time to complete my task, and Jim works best when he's under a ridiculous deadline. So while we knew those things about each other, I think actually doing something together that had to conform to both of our styles was it uncomfortable?
We went back to my hometown of Redlands, California, and it took 6 months off from the Atlantic, and just had this little house where we had a whiteboard mapping out where we had to get each week and each day. And, you know, the secret of writing a book, even a fairly long one like this, is if you do a certain number of words per day, you get done. And so we did that pretty much.
We did that pretty much. Yeah, it was actually surprising. Maybe that's what was surprising. We actually did what we said we were going to do. And that whiteboard, was...
You guys strike me as people who are habitually doing what you say you're going to do, even if it sounds kind of wild.
This you have seen to the heart of one of our strategies in life, which is to lock ourselves into doing something by telling people we're going to do it.
That's right.
That's how we went to China, 12 years ago. A year or so in advance, we started telling people we're going to move to China. After a while, I said, well, what are you doing here?
We thought you were going to move to China.
Yeah, why are you still in D.C.? And so we've done that a number of times. And we said we're going to write this book about it. So it's, yes, there is that publicly locking yourself into doing something.
Yeah. And since you had written far many more books than I had, I would say, I don't think I've ever said this to you before, but I did follow your lead in how to work on this, what to worry about and what not to worry about, and how to just trust that, this will all come together.
Can we spend like one more second with that? How do you, now that you've learned, how do you do that?
I think the key is the trust. That means you're willing to go back and reorganize something or redo something or reconfigure that would, in my opinion, radically reshift the package of what you're doing, which makes me uncomfortable because I like to have that structure from the get-go and kind of stick to it. So that was hard, but you were right.
This is an unusual moment you're hearing. Here are two tips I have internalized about book writing from friends over the decades. One is, there's a wonderful novelist named Charles McCary. He wrote this fabulous book, The Tears of Autumn, and many other books. And he had been a spy in his youth and a presidential speechwriter, just a wonderful person, Charles McCary. And one of the things he said about book writing is that each day or each night, stop, if you figured out step 10, stop when you've written step 9. So that it's easy to start the next day. You can start the next day with something you've already figured out, so you have that kind of momentum. You're already going downhill. And I think that's really important, because otherwise you can spend the first hour the next day just being stalled. The other is, I was friends with the famous novelist Michael Crichton, who wrote a zillion novels. And there was one famous week where he had the number one movie, the number one TV show, and the number one best-selling book all at the same time. It was a real polymath, and he died younger than I am now, of sudden cancer. But he said that when he was writing a book, he tried to avoid all other distractions or choices in his life. So he had the same thing to eat at every meal. and he wore exactly the same clothes. And just, you know, he wrote books quickly, so he'd do this for like 2 months. We couldn't do this for 6 months, but trying to say, there's lots of things I'm not going to think about so I can concentrate on things I do need to think about.
Which leads me to one of the reasons that Jim loves being a pilot and loves flying a plane, because in this journalistic life where he is naturally involved in a lot of commentary, breaking news, distracting, especially Washington life, when we get in that plane, and Jim is responsible for being the pilot and flying it, it's complete tunnel vision onto those controls, onto the weather, onto the actualities of flying the airplane. And while it takes a lot of concentration, I can also see the relaxation of you're just not allowed to let anything else into your mind. But for you, I see that as also really a relaxing thing.
So there are people who might take up yoga or Zen meditation. Right. I say, why not spend years getting a pilot's license, get an airplane and fly around the country? But no, I think Deb says, I find it really absorbing and beautiful and exhilarating. And it does, I can't worry about anything else.
Was your process for getting your pilot's license the same as going to China? Did you just tell people for years, I want to be a pilot, I'm going to get my pilot's license, and then you did it?
Yes. And the, one of the people I told was Deb, who was sort of putting the kibosh on it for a long time.
Well, we had a deal. It was called Not Until the Kids Are Grown. And then when our youngest was, actually the day his college letter came in from where he wanted to go, Jim said, oh, there's this airport in Gaithersburg. So,
ready,
and
huh?
Fine, deal accomplished. And he went off to learn to be a pilot.
Can I ask you a question? This is not really very journalistic, although maybe it is. Like, that instinct, like, that feels a little bit like a little kid to me. Like, it was Christmas, so you could open your present was becoming a pilot, and you'd been waiting 20-something years to do it. Like, it seems like both of you guys have that spirit, and I wonder how it's continued.
For people of mature years?
For people of mature years. Seriously, yeah. Like, you guys just embarked on this crazy project. You flew around the country, went to all these small towns. The project itself is ambitious and optimistic. Moving to China is ambitious and optimistic. Where do you guys find the ambition and the energy and the optimism for those projects?
To wax serious for a moment, my dad, who died 10 years ago or so, was different from me in many, many ways, but he ended up as a very, very accomplished small-town doctor. He grew up in a non-college family. The Navy sent him to medical school. He was a Navy doctor, and they moved out. He got a glimpse of California after his Pennsylvania upbringing. He thought, this is where I want to be. So he moved us there, which is where we grew up. And he was, the point I'm making is, he was a perpetual little boy in the sense of his enthusiasm for everything, that he more successfully in George W. Bush learned to be a painter after he retired from medical practice. And he rode his Palomino horse in the Rose Bowl parade every year and became the head of the mounted police in our little town, riding on horses. And I think that he imbued on our family the sense of just permanent excitement. So that's one point. I don't think I'm like my dad that much, but I think I'm more like my mom. But that sort of perpetual enthusiasm is something that I recognize from him. Also, this line of work of being a reporter, I've always thought is by far the most fortunate thing I could ever do, the only thing I could ever really sensibly do, but also is just such a privilege in being able to keep, your life should be a sequence of adventures, with it, of finding out about things and indulging the twin instincts to find out and to tell. Those are our two basic impulses, but it's been so. For family heritage and occupational structure, and also because nobody likes a grumpy old man. I think those are the reasons I try not to be a grumpy old man.
And I guess I have a version of that, partly the same. So I grew up in the Midwest, Minnesota, Chicago, Northern Ohio, and they were great places to grow up. There's a real grounding sense from growing up there. But there's also a real sense that you need to get out and see the world, because it's so flat and it's so stable in that part of the country that you want to leave. How many people do you know from Ohio? I bet lots. Mm-hmm. No matter where I go, somebody's there are always these huge clots of people from Ohio, I think because they want to get out of Ohio. I love Ohio, but it's the Midwest is a great place to grow up and a great place to leave from. The other is from my dad as well, who the mantra from him in our household was, go ahead and try it. It'll be a good experience. So my sister and I were encouraged to do a lot of things that back in the day, you know, now it's different, but back in the day, do boy things. Like we had to mow the lawn. I mean, I hated that. We had to learn how to fix car engines. I hated that. But there was always an encouragement to try things, even if they were uncomfortable or even if you might fail, like how bad could it be? It'll be a good experience. And I think that that voice from him in my head has always been something that has said, go out and try it or go out and do it.
And there was a moment, I think, in our early married life where a decision or wish by you had a complete lasting fork in the road impression. So we got married in 1971, right after Deborah graduated from college, after I was in graduate school for a year. We came back to the U.S. in 1972. I worked for the Washington Monthly, which was then getting started up as, you know, this political magazine. For 2 years, I was right at age 22, was right in the center of a lot of political journalism then. And the natural thing for somebody like me would have been to stay in D.C.
Yeah.
And just say, okay, what's the next step with a big newspaper and I was starting to write for national magazines and all that. But that was the time instead we moved to Austin, Texas. And the reason was?
I was really unhappy in Washington, D.C. and didn't want to stay there. And I wanted to go back to what I really loved, which was what I studied as an undergraduate, linguistics, and go ahead and try that in graduate school. So much to Jim's credit, he came with me and left a career that was just starting for, we didn't know what it was going to be for him professionally, so that I could be happy too, and so that I could start to find my way too. And it felt like a big deal at the time. I mean, I think it was a big deal. It was in the, you're going where? You're doing what? We all know Austin's a great place, but at the time we didn't know
And I worked for a young then state senator named Lloyd Doggett. We became, you know, sort of quasi-Texan, but I think the point is that in the time since then, we've lived sort of half the time in D.C. and half other places. And that was the beginning of thinking we should have structural, permanent revolution in our life.
Yeah. There's always been a push-pull factor. There's been a push out of, I'm not going to say the swamp, because I actually have come to like D.C. quite a lot after all these years, but a push factor out of where we lived and a pull factor to all these other amazing places that we might go to.
Do you guys remember what those conversations were like about moving to Austin?
I remember that Deb was working then as a legal secretary and had what we could refer to as bad attitude as a worker.
It was like fired. Yeah.
And so the question was, for linguistics graduate school, do we go back to Cambridge where we'd gone to college? We're undergraduate at Harvard. Do you go back to MIT for graduate school or to Stanford or to Texas? And for various reasons, Texas seemed like the most attractive program and a great adventure. And so we thought, what the hell?
We were absolutely right. I mean,
I guess that was like a sort of passive way of asking, like, were you not in those conversations? Like, I'm doing some shit here. I'm on a path. Like, how did you guys navigate?
I think one of my mentors, whom I won't name on the chance that he might hear this at some point or hear about it, was telling me I was making this gigantic life mistake.
I didn't ever hear that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do.
And that if
just
I...
Just name names.
You know, if I wanted to be the editor of the Washington Post, or if I wanted to be the, you know, D.C. correspondent for this or that publication, this was just the wrong time to step off the carousel. And in fact, it was, of course, in purely crass professional terms, it was the best thing I could possibly have done, just to be sort of introduced to the rest of the world. It's just not of the standard career path.
Yeah.
And to have a different kind of career path of just learning about a whole range of things as opposed to just the world of D.C.
But were you aware of that then? Or did it feel like I'm going to do the right thing, even if it's not the right thing professionally?
How did it feel, Jim?
I pouted a little bit. I
did
think
because
I remember that improbably I had two freelance assignments when we headed down to Austin. One was my first ever assignment for The Atlantic, where I was going to do a profile of Lloyd Benson, then preparing a run for the presidency. So that was one thing to do. The other was, weirdly, a commission from Playboy magazine to do a profile of Warren Burger, the Justice of the Supreme Court. I'm just reporting here. I'm just reporting. So for a while, I was sort of commuting back and forth from Austin and thinking, why have I been ripped away from the glamorous life of Warren Burger profiles? So, but I did the Lloyd Benson, the Warren Burger profile got killed, although they paid me. The Lloyd Benson profile worked, and I did then another piece for The Atlantic from the world's largest slaughterhouse in Amarillo. About sort of the beginnings of the animal rights movement. Then,
and it was also that Jimmy Carter, I think, saw those pieces in The Atlantic, and that was how you first...
And The Washington Monthly also, yeah.
Yeah, joined his campaign. There's one other thing, though. This was a really long time ago, and I think people's ideas, young people's ideas of their careers and career paths have changed over the times. When I watch our kids who are a bit older than you and your age, kids, fully fledged adults and somewhat younger, plan their lives and careers, I see a lot more planning and explicit vocalized compromise making, trajectory organization of how my career will go going on than it was in our era, which...
It all sounds so pejorative when you say it.
No, I'm saying we were really reckless.
Yeah.
Sounds awesome.
but it was sort of a... So our parents, who are of the World War II generation, got married very young. You know, my mom was 20 when I was born, and your parents were young too. And so they were doing a bunch of just roll-the-dice things. And I think we were sort of in the roll-the-dice mode too. I was not sure I wanted to be in this journalism business at all anyway. It was just, you know, giving it a try before doing something more serious. And so it was all just... trial and error with a number of errors.
And it was also, really, it was post, this is going to sound so old, but it's true, it was post-Vietnam era when we were just glad to be alive. And, you know, people had other serious, more serious problems than we do of trying to figure out what your career was going to be and if you were taking a slight deviation in your path. So I do think a lot of it was the times and not, and being able to risk it more. And having that be a normal thing.
It's almost like you guys were like, you were playing with like house money.
Yes. Yeah, it's true. And there was a certain, I think we lacked a tragic imagination of how things could go wrong.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah.
We were just kids.
When Carter came calling, how did you guys make that choice?
So I think we signed on the day before we discovered you were pregnant with what would become our first son. So that was sort of, that was part of rolling the dice. But this was more intentional, believe it or not, which is one of my early mentors, perhaps referred to earlier in this conversation, a man named Charles Peters, who was the editor of the Washington Monthly, had said that if you want to be right about politics as a journalist, some time in your life, you should try to work in it one time. And Charlie had worked for the John F. Kennedy campaign in West Virginia and then had been senior figure in the Peace Corps. And his argument was, if you do it one time, you're just going to know things you can't know otherwise and do it once. So you're not commuting back and forth. So when out of the blue, some friends in the Carter campaign in the spring of 76 said, we're looking for more talent, why not? What do we have to lose, essentially? Most candidates at that stage are going to lose. So it'd probably be a half-year adventure, and I've learned things I wouldn't know otherwise. And so that was sort of, it was rolling the dice again.
And then you ended up in the White House.
Yes, through improbable circumstances. On the campaign as the kid junior speechwriter, you know, on the plane for 6 months, then the senior speechwriter, then Patrick Anderson, a very good writer and a good friend, got crosswise of Jody Powell. And so I moved up the food chain and became the head speechwriter for 2 years until I then got crosswise of Carter, and Rick Hertzberg of The New Yorker moved up the food chain after me.
Wait, first of all, just using the phrase crosswise seems to me to be like a phrase that someone who never gets crosswise with anyone would use. But wait, what was your falling out with Jimmy Carter about?
Jimmy Carter, number one, has been the best former president in American history. Number two, accomplished a lot more as president than most people give him credit for, from deregulating the craft beer industry to and creating what is all around us to the Camp David Agreement. and number three would have been a very good sort of judge or dictator, because he always wanted to do the right thing but was less sort of intent on getting it done. On the other hand, he was not that good of a speaker, I contend, as his speechwriter. And so there was sort of a structural crisis that was involved in being his speechwriter. So, and just to go an inch deeper, he was quite a good extemporaneous speaker to crowds of 200 people, which is how he became president. You know, he went around the country and people thought, well, this guy has the magic. And after Watergate, he was not good at like an inaugural address or a speech to Congress or these other things that you have to do as president. And so it just was something I was glad to have done, but was not really cut out to do. Mm-hmm. And so we parted ways, and I wrote an analysis in The Atlantic saying there's problems coming for Carter, and he took that the wrong way, understandably.
Can I ask two more questions about this, and then we'll go back to the book? I'm just curious about it. One is, so if the goal was always just to work in it once and learn what you can, what'd you learn? And how did it inform your journalism?
So this, here are a couple of specific things that I always refer to because they're so vivid. One is you underestimate how tired people in at the White House are. It just being tired is much bigger explanatory factor than you would think. That during the course of, and it's a huge advantage for an incumbent president against a challenger, because the incumbent president can usually sleep in his own place each night, and the challenger is on the road in these motels. And just as I was, you know, 26, 27 when I was doing this, and I felt like I was 98 years old just because I was, you know, having to get up at 3:30 a.m. And so the role of fatigue. Another thing which really struck me is how 95% of the time, blunder and incompetence is the explanation for something. That from the outside, you want to put things together in some kind of pattern. Oh, you know, the Secretary of State must have said this because of some hint from the president. And usually it's just they never returned a phone call, or they didn't know what they were doing, or they were jealous. So those practical matters impress me. I guess more generally, I have a residual respect for people who will get into politics, because it is really, really hard. And so people, I mentioned earlier, Lloyd Doggett, who was a mid-20s-year-old state senator when I worked for him in Texas, is now a man of mature years in the U.S. Congress. I really respect people who will just keep on doing it and are willing to put up. Can I say one more thing? Most of us in our life, if there's one person who is really mad at us, it drives us crazy. As a politician, you have to accept that millions of people will hate you, and you can still be considered a success. And that is a different kind of cast of mind. The end.
Are you guys good at being okay with it when people are mad at you?
I don't like having people mad at me.
This is a discussion. We've had this discussion. Shall we rehearse it?
Sure.
Deb, people are going to attack us. They're not going to like things about this book. Even if it does really well, people are going to attack
us. But why would they do that?
because we're saying things that are controversial. People are not always fair in their judgments. We know what we meant. People aren't always going to agree with that. And people are going to say, oh, you're coming there in your airplane. It all looks fine to you, Mr. Jet Setter and Miss Jet Setter, with your privilege. And that is going to happen.
I know. It's much harder for me. Don't they understand, you know, where we're coming from and why we're doing this?
They could just hear us talk for an hour. They'd like us.
If there's only some way.
No, it's a problem for me. It's not a problem for you. You've been in journalism your whole life. And people find it easy to criticize. They don't always find it easy to compliment. I've avoided confrontation my whole life as much as possible. So this is not a part of it that comes naturally to me. I'm just trying to bear up.
How's it going?
So far, so good.
But nobody has attacked us yet. As of the moment we're all having this conversation, we've gotten some attacks. Yeah. But there hasn't been a really big one, which I'm sure there will be.
And there's one part. I mean, I totally believe in this book, in this message. And just want to say, you try it. You go out there and see all these places and then tell us what you think. So I feel we've been as thorough and careful about reporting honestly and faithfully what we've seen and heard as we could possibly be. So that's the best we can do.
I feel like I can imagine what some people listening to this are thinking I can imagine their attack, which is not necessarily on the message of the book, but is more on the privilege aspect of it, which is like so many people would like to fly around the country in their own plane doing this reporting, doing these projects. So many people would like to move to China for how many years?
Total of about four in different, a little less than four in two installments.
And just explore the place. And I can imagine that some people are listening, don't have attacks formulated, are just jealous and pissed. And maybe yes, as a way of paying them back, you could offer some advice on how you have figured out how to scam things to the point that people will pay you to do this.
We feel enormously fortunate in life. We're fortunate. We are beyond fortunate in health and in our family, and not all breaks have gone our way, but a number of them have. And so we are, I think we try to be aware every second of how we can't be fully aware of our good luck, but we try to be. Also, I spend every second of my life working. There's no time I'm not on the clock, except when I'm flying the plane. And I think that the idea of people think like we would be sent to China on a big expense account. You know, we showed up, we stayed for the first 2 weeks in Shanghai in a hotel where all the other occupants, all of them were Russian or Ukrainian merchant seamen. You know, that was the merchant seamen's hotel in Shanghai. We never stayed in anything other than like a Motel 6 or whatever on this flying around the last number
of
years.
And also, this is not like renting an exec jet and going on. This is a little propeller plane that if it's hot outside, you're hot. If it's cold outside, you're freezing. There's no bathroom. There's no food. You know, you get to the FBO and you pray for a vending machine with those peanut butter cheese crackers for breakfast and lunch. You land someplace and there may well not be a rental car or an Uber or a taxi. So you have to kind of wait till some guy comes down the road in a pickup and will take you into town and hope that there's room at the inn, which is, you know, Red Roof or Motel 6 or no name hotel. So that is not to complain. That is to set the record straight that we're on the ground schlepping a lot. I mean, that's what we do.
Yes, and that is true. And also it's true that no one will hear anything involving a personal airplane and not think, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I mean, but I think it's actually pretty important. If part of the answer to that question is not, listen, I reached a point in my career where I've got tenure at one of America's foremost magazines and they'll let me do whatever I want and this is what I want to do. Part of the answer is that is true. And also I do it at almost no expense to them and some large amount of physical discomfort to me and my family.
And it is, again, I'm careful in putting this out in the Times. In the 4 years we lived in Japan and Malaysia and the almost 4 years we lived in China, what the Atlantic did for us was to pay my salary. And that was it. I mean, everything else, we rented out our house and it was not like they were financing trips back and forth. So they continued to pay my salary, which I'm very grateful for, but the rest is something we all just figured out how to do.
We figured it out. But also, if we were to do this all over again, I would honestly choose it the same way rather than being assigned to. I was really envious of the people who were in the countries who had been assigned by their bureau from the Times or whatever, that they had houses found for them, the school's tuition paid, and
the
driver.
You mean the other journalists that you guys have known across the world over the years?
Or people there on like law firms or
law
businesses
firms
or
things. Yeah, not all of them. I mean, there were versions of this story across the board, but one thing that I think we came to entirely value out of the hoofing around that we did was what we saw by doing that. I tried to calculate how many times we'd been on the Beijing and Shanghai subway rather than with a driver or in a taxi. And I just lost count. I mean, it was...
We actually worked it out. It was like 1,500 trips on the Beijing subway because we knew from how many cards we had re-upped, as opposed to our friends who had never been on the Beijing subway after living there at the same time.
And it would have been great in a way to not have to be on the Beijing subway so many times. But I'm telling you, you learn a lot by being on the Beijing subway, just watching people go in and out and listening to them talk and ending up in the wrong place or seeing what happens when it breaks down or when your pocket gets picked.
Getting robbed.
Yeah, or things like that. So all of those little moments accumulated into a very genuine and memorable experience.
And fortunate.
Yeah.
When you guys got here before we turned on the microphones, I was complaining to both of you about how like tired I am, and how like I've got so much to do, and I'm exhausted, and I'm a little embarrassed now, having heard you guys talk about this, to have been complaining about my like 20-minute commute on the subway to my office. But we talked about this a little bit, but I'm just going to ask it again because I'm personally interested. How exactly, if you could just fill in this blank for me, like how exactly have you guys sustained the energy to live this way? How do you do that?
We get a lot of exercise. I mean, we make a point of always getting exercise, right?
That's true. I think that's the number one important thing in our day is to be sure we get some exercise. And it's, you run and use the rowing machine, and I do yoga, and I swim and ride my bike. And it's as much mental as it is physical. It's just that break to do the reset and kind of start over again. And we are very fortunate, knock on wood so far, to not have any major health issues, mm-hmm. which becomes the big deal yeah. as you get older.
And I mean, we have, I guess also, I have the model of both of our fathers never thought of themselves as old. They yeah. thought of themselves as sort of bushy-tailed, and I think that imprint is in both of our minds.
One thing I've been thinking about more is at this age and having these opportunities and feeling good, you have some responsibility to this privilege of the life that you get to have by keeping going, by going out to do more things and trying things that are hard and challenging yourself. So I think there is some kind of nagging thing in my mind. Maybe it's because I grew up as a Catholic or something that makes me think you have to do this too.
So what are you going to do next?
I think in a way we would not have anticipated 2 or 3 years ago, we really have religion on this American revival theme that if we start with the observation that there are some problems in national politics right now, one thing that I professionally could do would be to dig right in the middle of that in the D.C. Angle and become another voice in the struggle in D.C. And I would flatter myself that I could have some role in that struggle, be one more voice in that struggle. The other thing is that I think there's a real shortage of people in our line of work paying attention to these countervailing positive things that are happening around the country that we believe are real and that we believe need more attention and with more attention could have more potential success. So I think our next stage is to try to figure out in what practical ways we can try to pull some of these strings together and tell more of the stories and draw more attention and go to more of these places too.
And connect people with each other who are in like-minded pursuits. You know, the startups in Greenville with the startups in Fresno and the ones in Montana, or the rural artists in Iowa to those in Arizona, just to give voice to some of these messages of optimism and how to do it that we've heard from people so they can feel like they're part of a movement and not alone in the efforts that mm-hmm. they're doing. I think we'd really like to do that.
And give one very practical illustration. You know, the meta theme here is there's lots of experimentation going on around the country to find what's going to be the right answer, the right combination of answers. And just today we were talking to somebody who said, we were observing that the two great crises we see at the local level are number one, opioids, and number two, local journalism and the economic pressures on it. And this guy we were talking with was saying, well, really the answer would be to convince today's rich people that they need to set up endowments for local journalism. You know, that Jeff Bezos for the Washington Post, that's great, but there need to be 10 more people doing that for 200 more papers and having some version of the Peace Corps, some version of the International Executive Service Corps, or other practical ways. So finding innovative ways actually to address these real problems mm-hmm. is interesting to me.
It's a theme throughout the book that this breakdown in the fabric of these small towns and counties losing local journalism. And it feels like actually the book is like so like optimistic and kind of like dissonantly optimistic. Yeah. But since you have been to these places and most people listening have not, help me understand exactly what you guys saw on that front.
Local journalism is under, and the default condition would be for it to go down and down and down. For example, in my hometown of Redlands, California, when I was a kid, and for a long time before that, there was a family-owned newspaper that really was the center of the town, the Redlands Daily Facts. So the Daily Facts is still there, but it's part of this news chain that is so much in the news from the Denver and, you know, the Alden Group or whatever it is. And so they are under tremendous pressure in lots of places we've been. In our chapter on Allentown, we talk about a lot of the great reporting from reporters for the Allentown Morning Call. Everybody we cite in that book from 3 years ago is now doing something else other than working on the Morning Call. So there are, that is the great pressure. And also there are people who found ways to turn it around, both in Burlington, Vermont with 7 Days, which is the one-time alt-weekly there that's become sort of the state's newspaper. They are robust in their print edition. In Erie, the Erie Weekly Reader is sort of taking over the slack that the normal morning newspaper is not doing. And there, it's an experimentation. There are some cases of success. There's a larger problem like that of newspapers in general. And our goal, our purpose here is to say, look, it's still a time of possible inflection. This is where money, attention, talent, innovative ways, like we were hearing this morning, of some of these senior editors who've been laid off from newspapers and Time, Inc., find some program where Peace Corps-like, they can go out to these places in the Dakotas or in Texas and work on...
And train the next generation of journalists who would then go out there and do that. Hmm. So this is a real kind of stand-up moment for philanthropists. Yeah. And
the future is being decided even now.
It's an optimistic idea.
But it could actually work. Yeah.
And real, so two sort of augustness of age points. One is we've lived through a lot of bad times for America. And I guess to stop being coy by this, we're 68 years old. That's how long we've been around. And so we grew up in the shadow of the Cold War and being blown up by the H-bomb. And there was, the 1960s were no picnic, 1970s were terrible. In the 80s, there were all of the Japanese challenges. There's been a lot of trouble in the U.S. And so the U.S. has faced a lot of these dire trends, and we've seen some of them prevail, but also some of them being resisted and turned around. And it depends on not giving in, saying it actually... it's a struggle, and it's worth engaging in the struggle.
Do you have anything to add, Deb?
Other than, oh, shut up.
Oh, shut up.
That's what she was thinking.
Maybe just one other point. One of the things we've enjoyed most about this whole adventure is the opportunity to stay in touch with people who are a whole lot younger than we are, to see what we always just refer to as the kids becoming full-fledged adults and taking on new responsibilities and roles and acting on their dreams. I think I'll run for Congress. I'm going to try to do this startup here in Duluth because I want to live in Duluth. We want to create a different kind of school, so I'm going to get together with a couple of my neighbors and make a charter school. You know, it's a different way of operating from when we grew up, and it's really inspiring and makes me believe in the spirit that this country started with and is still going on with. It's a new iteration of things that are happening. And rather than screaming about kids get off my lawn, I want them all to come onto my lawn, you know, and have a picnic there.
As long as they don't bring a leaf blower.
Right, with no leaf blowers, right. Bring the beer and we'll grill or something.
And one more philosoph business. I mean, my dad especially, my mom was an emotionally complicated person, but my dad would say that you can't control everything in your life, but you can sort of decide on the degree of happiness of your response. You know, things are going to happen to you, but there are some of the responses within your control. I think we've tried to absorb that.
Sound right?
Wait till the next bad review.
Yeah. Ask me next week.
Deb, Jim, thank you guys.
Next, thank you
thank
so
you
much.
Thank you, next.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Janelle Pfeiffer. And this week we are saying goodbye to our intern, Angela Velez. Angela has been amazing If you are listening to this and are in the position to give aspiring radio producers a gig, reach out to me, max@longform.org. You need to get in touch with Angela Velez. I also want to welcome our new intern, Tyler McCloskey. Tyler, welcome to the Longform Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you. Our show is brought to you, as it is every week, by the fine people at MailChimp. Thanks to them for their support. And thanks to Jim and Deb Fallows for coming in and teaching me once again how to try to be an optimistic person in the world. We'll see you next week. Psych. Actually, I want to tell you one more time about our good friends at Mubi. Mubi is a curated streaming service. There's only 30 movies on there at once, so you don't have to do that thing where you're clicking around for 45 minutes to actually pick what you want to watch. Everything on Mubi is good. They've got actual humans that pick actual good movies. There's classics, docs, masterpieces, new indie stuff. There's 30 movies at a time, a new movie every day. And it's a great thing. You don't have to do all the work of picking out what you want. They're just going to put something great in front of you. Try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/longform. That's mubi.com/longform for your extended free trial. Go check it out. Okay, now, actually, we'll see you next week.